Hi everybody, Quentin here from Modo. We're at Modo HQ with Claire King, a very good friend and a colleague who I've worked with for many years now. And we're absolutely delighted to have Claire on to talk about legal stuff and being a lawyer in the energy storage industry, contracts, and everything we need to look out for. So Claire, absolutely delighted to have you on and thanks for coming in. Let's get straight to it. So what does a lawyer do in our industry?
The answer question is advise on the law. it's a few things. So obviously we do all the contracts involved in developing and operating battery storage projects. And we also advise on the regulatory side of things. So yep. Ensuring that developers and investors, asset managers, etc., stay on the right side of the law and the energy industry regulation, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about. It can be challenging because the regulation is pretty slow in terms of catching up with the current market.
Yeah, so I guess a lot of your customers, a whole energy sector that is, I almost said the word rigged there. It's not rigged. An energy sector that is designed for generation, right? We're trying to make energy storage work in that, which isn't really generation like that. So lots to talk about there. You've been around for sort of, I think, 6 years in the energy storage industry. We've worked on a lot of projects together over the years.
Since I was 21.
So can you just talk a little bit about what you've worked on? And of course, you work for Freeth now, who have a fairly big very large presence in this space. And what do they do to, go for it.
Okay, so you're right. Personally, I was involved in some of the first large-scale battery storage projects in the UK back in sort of 2015, 16. So they've now been operational for getting on for 5 years, which is a pretty good track record. But yeah, at Freeth, we've got a big energy, clean energy team. It's about 45, 50 lawyers strong across different legal practice areas, real estate, planning, construction. We've got a core team of energy geeks who deal with the tricky stuff like optimization contracts, the regulatory side. We've got corporate and finance lawyers that do acquisitions and disposals and things like that. So that's the team at Freeth. And currently we are very busy on battery storage. I would call it the sexiest asset class we're currently working on. We're probably advising on about 2 gigawatts of projects at the moment at different stages of development. So yeah, pretty significant chunk of our current business is storage.
And are you involved throughout the whole value chain? So I mean, from supply, development, contracting, building, operations, O&M, disposal, all of that? You do all of it?
Yeah, we do all of it. So, right from the early stages when you've got the stage one developer pulling together land rights for the project, getting planning permission, securing a grid connection, do it all of that. And then once they've compiled the project rights, they might look to flip the project to somebody else. So we deal with the acquisition or sale of the project at that stage, the due diligence that might be carried out on the project by the buyer. We then deal with all the construction contracts to actually build it. That might be a wrapped EPC contract dealing with all of it, wrapping in the grid connection works as well, potentially. But we've also dealt with projects where all of those things are separated out. So you might have a separate battery supply and install contract, a separate balance of plant contract, a separate grid connection works contract. So that might be an ICP contract or other. So it can be structured in different ways. But yeah, we deal with all of that. In particular, we look at the battery warranty terms because it's obviously something we've dealt with before, Quentin.
Every time it's different.
But it's so important in terms of feeding into the optimization services contract, which is something that our team of energy geeks deal with. And I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But it's optimization contracts are really interesting because they're just developing so quickly. There's no standard form. Every single one we look at is different. Every client wants something slightly different out of it. Every optimization services provider is offering something slightly different depending on the client's requirements. So,
question on that: do you work on both sides? So I know when we've worked together, it's often been for the client, so for an investor or acquirer, or usually the folks with the money who are buying the service or the thing. Mm-hmm. Do you also work on the other side? So do you work with optimizers or folks selling these services to help them structure those contracts as well, or do they tend to do that in house?
No, we work on that too for optimizers. Right. Yeah.
So you see the pain from both sides.
See the pain from both sides, indeed. Yes. Obviously, we have to navigate conflicts in that.
I didn't mean like that. But
But it's actually quite helpful to see it from both sides because if you're in the mindset of a provider versus provider versus customer, it gives you different perspectives, and it's quite helpful to try and find a solution that's going to work for both sides, because ultimately you want to get the contract agreed as quickly and painlessly as possible.
Yeah, of course.
And we've had some painful ones.
I want to ask you a very difficult question now, but I want to know your opinion on it. Is this sector maturing from a contract and a legal perspective? Or is it always... why am I asking this question? Well, the last few years, it's felt like the regulations and the way that we operate and the way that we contract for this stuff have not really kept up with the technology and the revenue streams. And it's felt like the world of energy storage has almost moved faster than all of the supporting infrastructure. And is that changing? Or is that gap getting bigger?
No, I think it's changing. I think it's changing. And the real reason it's changing is people are becoming better educated about the sector. They understand it better, particularly investors who tend to be the, I don't want to call them slow, but in terms of understanding the market and how it works and how the revenue is realised.
I guess they got other stuff to do, right?
They got other stuff to do, yeah. But understanding is definitely improving. So if you look back to sort of solar projects, early days of solar projects, when they first started to get rocks, I mean, I can remember investors saying, oh, no, we don't want rocks because, you know, they don't have a fixed price and it's too risky and, you know.
Incredible.
They'd be falling over themselves for a rock project. So I think that's where we're going to get to, and we're definitely still on the journey, but I do think it's improving. In terms of, if you're asking whether contracts are now standardised, the answer is that's a firm no, which is good news for me, bad news for legal costs. So no, they're not yet standardised. We see quite a lot of variety, but it's because asset owners have differing requirements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to go back to optimization services contracts as an example, some asset owners might want to have a floor price, and they might want that because it's a requirement of their funder. They need to be able to stick a fixed revenue stream into their financial model and know that that is guaranteed for the lifetime of for the term of the optimization contract, at least. Whereas other asset owners will think, well, I don't want to pay for a floor, because that's ultimately you do have to pay for it. I'm prepared to take a bit more risk for a bit more reward. So, you know, that's just one example of two different approaches, which can have a significant impact on the form of the optimization contract.
We're going to go down a rabbit hole here. Forget the agenda, right? So floor prices. For an investor who's investing in an asset, a floor price protects them against downside, basically, right? Doesn't it? It means that they're going to get, hopefully, a positive NPV or whatever. Are floor prices watertight? And what should investors or asset owners look for? Do optimizers really believe... a lot of these questions I have an opinion on. I'm just sort of throwing it out there, but I want to know what you think. Do optimizers, when they offer floor prices, are these contracts written to be watertight so that no matter what, the investor or the owner is going to get its payout? Or is it a bit more complicated than that? And what should we consider when we're talking about floor prices? Because I know you would have worked on a lot of them.
So are they watertight? Standard lawyer answer. It depends. Quentin. What is written into the contract? From an optimizer's perspective, they're not going to want it to be watertight in every scenario, because if the market changes significantly, they're not going to be tied into it. Look at the energy retail market at the moment. Prime example. So they're going to want certain caveats for sure, and whether they get them or not is a matter of negotiation.
So, for example, I mean, one of the things that often comes up is asset availability, right? If I'm not optimized and I want to write a floor contract with you and your assets only available half the time, then of course I shouldn't pay out all of the floor price. And then how do you measure that availability? And what if the availability is not your fault? What if it's my fault?
Yeah.
What if it's the communication between our two systems? And what if, oh man, it's just, we've got so much further to go.
You're bringing up some really painful memories, because I know exactly which contract you're talking about.
Yeah, it's tricky, you know? And you can see both sides are absolutely in their right mind to want everything.
And so
it's tricky. Anyway, we've gone down a rabbit hole on floor prices.
Well, here's another one for you. The other one is, how do you hold your optimizer to account? How do you know if they're doing a good job or not?
Yes, which is very tricky. Very, very, very tricky. We've got to be careful here because, of course, some folks use our, a lot of folks use our data to do all sorts of things. And one of the things is that. I guess the tricky thing about optimizers is, for the last few years, we're really going off on one now, but the tricky thing about optimizers, and I know because I used to work at one, is that we've all been talking about the merchant case for storage for so long, and the merchant case for storage is so much based on how good you are at buying and selling power and forecasting and choosing when to do the thing that you promised.
Yeah.
So everybody's been building these business cases, and optimizers have been doing an incredible job of selling their services before they've actually been operating assets in merchant.
Yeah.
And now we've got real assets operating merchant strategies, and you can see some assets doing better than others, right? And it's not just because of availability, and it's not just because of systems, different types of system and thermal issues and lots of the things it's blamed on. Some of it is because optimizers are choosing to do different things.
Yeah.
And so you have to say, at some point you've got to say, well, if you spent the last 2 years talking about merchant, let's see, can you do it, right? And
yeah.
So some are doing an awesome job and they're making incredible returns for their asset owners. And some optimizers are still clearly learning, they're on the learning curve. But the difficulty is if you've spent the last 2 years saying that you've got this AI neural network thing and you're going to absolutely smash it, then when the push comes to shove, you really do need to. So I really went off on a rant there. I don't know how we ended up doing that, but we are not the police of optimizers. We give data and we let our customers figure out what to do with the data. Wow, really felt like I really had to defend myself.
That felt
there.
Like therapy. Wow. Do you feel better after that?
Oh, man. Okay, so what else are we talking about? Can you talk about a project you've worked on recently? They're all interesting, but a particularly interesting one.
Particularly interesting one.
Some of the contracts stuff that happened, or the reg stuff that happened.
The contract stuff. Ooh, we're getting really juicy now,
aren't
we?
Yeah, I know.
Well, what can I talk about that's interesting? Well, I suppose the interesting trend at the moment, from certainly from our perspective, is joint ventures in this sector. So we dealt with one earlier in the year, and we're dealing with two at the moment, which are joint ventures between a developer who's brought projects to, or is bringing projects to, sort of shovel-ready stage, ready to build, and are entering into a joint venture with a funder who's going to stump up the cash.
Okay, right.
And what we're doing is putting in place sort of framework agreements whereby projects would be fed by the developer sort of into the joint venture, and then they each take a share. And ultimately, the aim is to build a portfolio of a certain, you know, hundreds of megawatts, typically even over a gig of projects. Hold it for a certain period of time, prove the operational capability of the portfolio, and then refinance or exit in some way.
Yeah.
So that is definitely a current trend we're seeing. As I say, we're doing two of those at the moment, and I suspect that's a trend that will continue.
So how does this work? So why is this good for the developer, and why is it good for the asset owner? So I guess that, just thinking it through, the developer, they know that someone's going to buy their sites, and so they can, but do they keep some of the upside?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it depends on the negotiating position.
Yeah.
But yeah. So it gives the developer security that somebody's going to buy these projects once they're developed to a certain stage, and provided they meet certain investment criteria. And each investor will have slightly different investment criteria, but if you can set those investment criteria out at the beginning, the developer knows what it's got to achieve in order to guarantee that it can sell the project into the joint venture, which will then guarantee that the investor puts the money in. Often through the joint venture, the investor will fund the construction. So again, that removes the need for the developer to have to raise separate construction finance, which can be difficult. There can also be a mechanic whereby the developer is compensated for its development costs up to the ready to build stage. So developer might take the risk for, you know, a few years actually, while the project is developed and getting developed through to having its all of its project rights in place. So land, planning, grid. But as soon as that project satisfies the investment criteria, they can be reimbursed for those costs.
Okay.
The construction costs are then taken care of through the joint venture, and then it's operational costs. Often the developer is retained as the asset manager.
Okay.
Post-energization, so they've got, again, a revenue stream coming from the asset management services. Back to your original question, do they still have a stake? Yes, typically is the answer. The share of the joint venture between the investor and the developer tends to vary. It depends on depends who's stumping up what cash and who's taking what risk. But yes, typically the developer will retain a stake, and when the joint venture exits from the portfolio, either refinancing or selling it, they will take a chunk of that.
Okay. And I guess it makes sense for the investor too, because they don't have to go through the beauty parade of looking at sites. They know they've got the sites, they know they've got to meet some certain criteria, they can just get on and build them, which...
Yeah. And they know they're comfortable with the developer. And we can, you know, we're looking to agree template contracts for all of this stuff. I mean, it's the dream, isn't it, to have a cookie cutter contract that you can just replicate for a number of projects. It never exactly works like that in practice.
Yeah.
But the more you can get contracts agreed up front, the better. Yep, so yep. things like an EPC contract, optimization services as much as possible, the form of the sale and purchase agreement by which the project company in which the project rights are held are transferred to the joint venture, all of that can be agreed up front. And then as projects start to come through the framework, you just sort of apply those template contracts to each project. So in theory, it makes the negotiation and document development process much simpler. And from an investor's perspective, they're not negotiating with multiple different developers, each having slightly different terms or very different terms. It's, in theory, the whole process is much more streamlined.
Yeah, okay, makes sense. And I just want to talk to you about grid connections, because they're a bit of a hot topic at the moment, and I know you see a lot of them. So the story right now in the market is that any grid connections for 2022 are really, they're worth gold, right? They're worth in gold. And so a lot of connections are available for 2023, 2024 and beyond. So a lot of connections, you know, there's still a bottleneck here. And so... what are you seeing in the grid connection offers, or how are you seeing the what's available change as the market's changing? So we're talking about active network management connections before, and what other things?
Yeah.
So what can you just talk through some of the things that folks need to think about when they are getting grid offers?
So what we're seeing at the moment is a lot of grid offers that were for things like peakers, gas peakers, being changed to battery storage, and even with the capacity significantly increased. So we saw one that was started life as a 49 meg gas peaker and is now a 99 meg battery.
Awesome. I mean, just yes for the world.
Yes for the world.
Battery for the win.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a win for the planet. Another rabbit hole. No, don't go down that. It's better than gas peakers. So the challenge there is that... obviously, there will be an original grid connection offer covering the, to use this as an example, 49 meg gas peaker. There'll have then been a dialogue between the developer and the DNO to say, well, actually, can we switch this around a bit?
Yeah.
Generally, there would then be a replacement connection offer saying, okay, instead of your gas peaker, you can have your 99 meg battery.
Yeah.
So you've got two live connection offers, and the developer has to choose which one to accept.
Okay.
So... What we've seen recently is the documentation not being exactly up to scratch. So you've got to be, I suppose my recommendation for developers is make sure you get all of this documented properly, because when an investor comes to due diligence it, they're going to be picking holes in it. They want to see exactly which connection offer you've accepted. They want to see that it's accepted within the acceptance window. They want to see that you've paid the deposit promptly. They don't want any risk of a technical breach of the grid connection offer, because as you know, if you lose a grid connection offer, you're stuffed.
Yeah. And I guess one of the important things here is that a 1 megawatt, that's a bad example, a 50 megawatt grid connection offer does not equal a 50 megawatt grid connection offer elsewhere necessarily, right? Because they can be different DNOs with different forms and different amounts that you need to pay and when you need to pay them, and some conditions that may be in that grid connection offer. So are you seeing DNOs be more creative? I guess DNOs are under pressure. They've got we had Ed Porter on a podcast, and we were talking about how much we need hundreds of megawatts, gigawatts more connections soon. So DNOs are under pressure. They've got to get people connected. So they're saying, okay, how can I get more connection offers out there? And so what they're doing is they're putting in conditions and things.
Yeah.
So which is fair enough. You know, you can see what, as is always the case, you can see why everybody's doing this stuff. So what do developers need to look out for in grid connection offers? I guess the first thing is read the offer.
That's so often people don't, Quentin.
Yeah.
Or no, they'll read the first line that says, 50 meg or whatever, you think, oh, I'm fine.
Yeah, get Moe out.
Yeah, exactly. Boop. yeah, read the connection offer. From a legal perspective, it's make sure you comply with all the terms, including any special conditions. Because coming back to what I was saying before, it's exactly what an investor is going to be looking for. I mean, I'm talking as somebody who would be due diligencing a grid connection offer for an investor, and that's exactly what I look for. Yeah. Have there been any technical breaches? If I know that certain DNOs do not issue formal documentation to record everything around this stuff.
Yes.
So a lot of it is dealt with through, I mean, ideally email correspondence, because then at least there's a written record. A lot of it's done by phone. So that is another big challenge. So again, advice to developers, get it all down on paper so that an investor coming in can see exactly how the grid connection has developed, how all the challenges have been overcome, and how you've got to the end point, which is acceptable for the project.
Okay. I'm going to talk about something a bit different now. So lawyers in our world, and I'm going to give you a bit of a layup here. So when should a lawyer be involved in the process? And the reason why I'm asking you this is, this isn't to scaremonger, but many projects that do go wrong could have benefited from some sort of support earlier on, right? And so the spending some money up front can often save some considerable money later. Yeah. So could you just give some examples of how getting a lawyer involved early can improve the returns of a project, and when folks should be calling up you and Freeth and saying, let's do this. I want to talk and get you involved.
Let's do some law. Okay, well, I can give you an example actually, because we've had one quite recently where when I'm talking here about very early stage project development, when stage one project developer is securing land rights to actually develop the battery. Often what they'll do is have some sort of informal agreement with the landowner to say, you know, we've got exclusivity over this site for a certain period of time while we go off and check that we can get planning and grid connection.
By informal, do you mean just like a handshake or...?
Documented, okay, often non-binding.
Okay, right.
But the first binding document they'll enter into is an option for lease, typically, of the site. Now, the option agreement will have attached to it the form of lease. And once you enter into the option will essentially say, once you, the developer, have got planning and grid connection offer, you will then exercise the option and enter into the lease.
Okay.
Now, when you sign the option agreement, the form of lease is attached. And once you've signed the option, not when you've exercised the option, when you sign the option agreement, i.e. before you've got planning and grid, it's then very difficult to change the form of lease. So you've got to make sure you've got the form of lease right from the outset. Okay. i.e. when you enter into the option agreement. Does all of that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. So even before you've actually signed, you're in the lease, when you're just signing an option, so you're allowed to take the lease. And if I'm not...
It's giving you an option to enter into the lease at some point in the future.
You need to be damn sure what type of lease you're going to be involved in later on. That's a layman's interpretation.
Okay. Because you can probably make sort of minor amends to the lease, but you can't make material changes. And the problem we've come up against recently is that the lease is then entered into in the form that was attached to the option agreement way back when the project was originally developed. And the form of lease isn't what we would call bankable. It means if a funder or an investor coming in at a later stage were to look at it, they'd say, well, I don't really like that provision.
Okay.
And then you're stuffed because you've entered into your lease, and unless your landowner is feeling generous and will let you amend the terms of your lease, the project might not be bankable, i.e. you might struggle to refinance it or sell it.
Tricky. Well, this word bankable, what else do we need to consider when we're talking about bankable? Because what else comes up in those conversations that people need to consider?
Well,
because I don't know anyone who's going to be financing this out of their own pocket, right? mortgaging the house, it'll have to be a bloody big house. So everybody needs some external finance, and all those external finance people need some to be comfortable. So what else can we look out for to make sure they're going to be comfortable? Other than the stuff we've just mentioned.
Yeah. So, you need to look at every document, basically every legal contract, to ensure that it's got the right provisions in it that that will satisfy a funder coming in at a later stage. Now, that can be provisions in the EPC contract, defects liability periods, that sort of thing, LDs, liquidated damages. It can be things like the floor in the optimization contract and the caveats around that.
Yeah.
I mean, the difficulty is that every funder is going to have a slightly different view of what is bankable and what isn't bankable. So all we can do is, based on our experience in the market, say this is what people tend to want. So the more you can make provision for those sorts of things in contracts from an early stage, hopefully the fewer changes you'll have to make when it comes to actually looking to exit the project.
That's an important distinction, right? It's because the word bankable is subjective. Right? Being bankable is subjective. It's the opinion of the folks at the bank or the investor and what they think is common sense. Right. So there is no bankable and non-bankable. There's just like, how much can you ensure, de-risk that someone's going to look at this and say, oh, this doesn't feel right. Just wanted to make a distinction because we say the word bankable or we hear the word bankable all the time and it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's not a strict set of criteria, that's for sure.
And I just want to finish up on a question, which is, what are the regulatory hot potatoes for energy storage at the moment? So I remember a few years ago, you and I, we worked on the idea that, and this is still the case, some distribution connected assets can be both exemptable from generation licenses and generation license holders at the same time, right?
Yes.
For embedded benefits and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so that was just a funny grey area that we worked on. I know there's plenty more. So what are the hot potatoes right now? What are the grey areas that the energy storage industry is trying to come to terms with, if you like?
Well, there's the biggie, which is that we don't have... storage isn't recognised as a separate asset class in energy regulation at the moment.
Yeah.
It's sort of shoehorned into generation, and obviously it isn't generation.
In the grid code and all that, right?
Yeah. And all of those changes are coming, apparently, but coming pretty darn slowly. Yeah. That's big challenge number one. Now, some of the problems around that have been solved, like there was the issue of double charging.
Yeah.
So you'd get charging and industry charges on the electricity that was imported, and then as you charge the battery, and then you pay the same charges again as the electricity was discharged back into the grid.
So crazy. I mean, obviously it's changed now, but you can't believe that was the way that it worked.
But it was for a while, right?
Yeah.
Now that has been solved. So what essentially is happening is that small fires are being fought, but the big fire hasn't yet been fought, which is that storage is shoehorned into generation. It just doesn't really belong there. So,
which is a very big piece of legislation that needs big changes, I guess.
And it's not just one piece of legislation, right? It's you know, there's the legislation, but then there are all the industry codes. You know, you mentioned the BSC, grid code, all of that stuff. All of it needs amending. It all needs to be aligned. I mean, and you know, storage is just a tiny piece of the jigsaw, right? Because the whole thing needs to be upgraded to reflect the decarbonisation and decentralisation of the electricity system.
And so I just want to finish off with, I want to talk about, are you involved in hydrogen at all? Any hydrogen projects? And I know this is an energy storage podcast, but I thought, while we've got you on, I thought you'd have an opinion on the state of hydrogen projects and the state of the hydrogen world out there, because we're taking a very close interest in it. It's important to everybody, right?
Yeah.
Well, whatever your opinion on... You can't just have an opinion on hydrogen because it's a varied thing, but whatever your opinions are on each stage of the new world of hydrogen that is appearing, it matters to all of us.
Yeah.
So what are you seeing from your vantage point?
Well, we're watching it quite closely. And obviously it's relevant to lots of different sectors. So that, you know, there's energy generation. I'm not sure it's going to actually be an important part of the energy generation mix. Could be part of the energy storage mix, mm-hmm. could be part of the heating solution, could be part of the transport solution. But wherever it is going to end up being used, we need hydrogen production, ideally green hydrogen production rather than blue. We need some sort of hydrogen distribution solution. You know, there's talk of repurposing the gas grid for hydrogen, but as far as I'm no metallurgist, but as I understand it, you'd need to blend hydrogen.
Some work to be done there.
It's not an easy solution, let's just say. And then you need hydrogen production. Storage somehow. You know, if you're going to produce large amounts of hydrogen, you've got to store it somewhere while you're waiting to then distribute it. Unless we end up with a highly sophisticated, you know, production and
just-in-time hydrogen model. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting market. We're watching it really closely. There are lots of opportunities there, lots of challenges too, I'm sure. What I would like to see as a clean energy lawyer, I'd like to see green hydrogen, you know, so hydrogen production facilities co-located with wind and solar and potentially battery storage and other good stuff. So hydrogen hubs. And I think at the moment, the hydrogen hubs that are being discussed are more sort of blue hydrogen hubs. So production with CCS. Yeah, I would like to see that transitioned to something a little bit cleaner.
And I told you the last one was the last question, but while we've got you on, one more. So what do you want to happen, right? What does the energy sector need? You're involved in, with all stages of not just energy storage, but all sorts of projects. And of course, your team are looking at the regulations and working with government and all that stuff. So what do we need? We've had a lot of big announcements recently. What are the problems that we need to solve in the next 10 years? I'm really putting you on the spot.
You're really putting me on the spot. I mean, I would say this as a lawyer, but the regulation needs to catch up. And I appreciate it's a challenge because the market moves so quickly. It's really, really difficult to keep pace, but the regulation has fallen way behind. So from my perspective, that would be a really helpful solution if we could have a full regulatory regime, not just the legislation, but also all the industry codes that reflects the modern electricity market. Okay. And is, can I have a second ask?
Yeah.
Also future-proofed.
Yeah. Easy peasy.
Easy.
All right, so we're going to leave it there. I just want to say thanks to Claire for coming on, and thanks to everybody who's watched this. Of course, please do like, share, subscribe, and all the good stuff. And we'll be with you soon with another video. Thanks very much.